The historian Cynthia Grant Tucker tells the following story. The Reverend Mary Safford and the Reverend Eleanor Gordon were celebrating their 10th year as pastors of Sioux City's First Unitarian Church in 1895. They assembled a souvenir anniversary book, which included the usual facts and figures about the growth of membership, building campaigns, pulpit exchanges, and memorable social events. One of the items in the book was an anecdote, which was clearly a congregational favorite. It read, "The fact that the Roman Catholic Church is just across the way from our own unity has not only caused many to speak of the close proximity of Rome and reason, but also has led to friendly exchanges between the members of the two choirs, while several times unity has been mistaken for the Catholic Church. One Saturday evening, when Judge Wakefield and the Reverend Miss Gordon were among the early arrivals at the Unity Club, a stranger entered, and looking at the judge, asked if he were the priest. The judge assured him that he was not, but pointing to Miss Gordon across the room, said the priest was over there. Stranger opened his eyes very wide, glanced about him, saw his mistake, and hurriedly said good night." 78 years later, in 1973, in Morristown, New Jersey, I was part of a group of women who presented a Sunday service about 20th century women. We quoted feminist theologian Mary Daly and other contemporary women writers, played women's music, and pointed out sexist language and assumptions in our culture, and even in some Unitarian Universalist writings. Later that week, at a meeting of the Sunday Services Committee, a woman said she had enjoyed the service. "I was wondering," she said, "do we have women Unitarian Universalist ministers? And if we do, could we invite one to speak here? I don't believe we've ever had a woman minister speak to us." "Oh, yes, of course we have women ministers," said our minister, who of course was a man. "Let me get the UUA directory and we'll find out which women ministers are nearby." Well, we pored over the directory for some time. There were no UU women ministers in New Jersey, or New York, or Connecticut, or Pennsylvania. We finally found one in Maryland, the Reverend Joyce Smith, and she did come to speak in Morristown. What pains and angers me is how little had changed in 78 years. All those years after the Eleanor Gordon anecdote, the woman on that committee in Morristown could still ask, "Do we have UU women ministers?" Even more painful to me as a woman minister is the fact that during all my time in theological school, I never heard about any of our 19th century women ministers. Toward the end of my studies at Star King, I received in the mail a little book called Universalist and Unitarian Women Ministers by Catherine Hitchings. It has short biographies of all ordained Universalist and Unitarian women ministers who were deceased as of 1975. I was astonished at the number of biographies, and I decided to count the number of women who had been ordained and were still alive in 1900. The number of living Universalist and Unitarian women ministers in 1900 was 101. In the back of the book was a list of living UU women ministers in 1975. When I counted them, I found there were only 41. There had been change, all right, but it was in the wrong direction. Most of us didn't even know that Augusta Chapin and her colleagues existed until that little book was published in 1975. And it wasn't until 1990 that historian Cynthia Grant Tucker published The Prophetic Sisterhood, which tells the stories of the liberal women ministers on the frontier. About 20 of those women came to be known as the Iowa Sisterhood. Conrad Wright, our leading Unitarian historian, describes the years 1865 to 1895 as a time when Unitarians were very much concerned with two things: growth and the quest for theological consensus. Does that sound a little familiar? During those years, very few Unitarian men were willing to take on the low-paying job of organizing new congregations on the frontier. So the women of the Iowa Sisterhood took charge of denominational growth in the West for two decades. They founded 15 churches, rescued others, built their own buildings by raising their own money. They took command of the West's strongest conference or district and held just about every office. Their presence was very much noticed in the West. But in the account of denominational growth given by Conrad Wright, not one word is written about the work of the Iowa Sisterhood. Jenkin Lloyd Jones is mentioned as one of the theological radicals. But in the West, the liberal religion preached by Jones and by the women of the Iowa Sisterhood was perceived simply as liberal, as practical, down-to-earth religion, open, inclusive, compassionate, and optimistic. These Western liberals perceived their Eastern colleagues generally as conservative. They were surprised at the retention of rituals such as communion and baptism, and the use of such terms as Christ to refer to Jesus. They resisted the hierarchical structures that put women at the bottom. And they were proud that Meadville Theological School admitted women and could not understand Harvard's refusal to do so. From an Eastern point of view, the Western Unitarians who opposed centralized hierarchy, female subordination, and narrow theology were radicals far to the left of center. But the West, according to the Reverend Marie Jenny, was a widespread web held together by threads of cooperation and sympathy between men and women. Theologically, the perceived center in the West was not the same as the perceived center in the East. The Iowa Sisterhood began in Illinois in the mid-1870s with two young women, Mary Safford and Eleanor Gordon. They made a pledge that they would spend their lives together serving the world as a team. Mary was determined to become a Unitarian minister. Eleanor was already an accomplished teacher and had been elected assistant high school principal. She envisioned herself helping Mary spread their enlightened religion along the frontier. And as a matter of fact, they did exactly that. Both Mary Safford and Eleanor Gordon were later ordained as Unitarian ministers. They started their ministerial careers by organizing church services in Hamilton, Illinois. Jenkin Lloyd Jones, who was then secretary of the Western Conference, gave them strong encouragement. Under the leadership of the two women, the Hamilton congregation grew in a year to 150, and they began holding additional services for a smaller group 8 miles away. Eventually, Jones suggested they go to Humboldt, Iowa, where the Unitarian Church needed a minister and the school needed a principal. From this move, there emerged over the next years a lively group of about 20 Unitarian women ministers known as the Iowa Sisterhood. Talented young women were taken under the wings of the two friends, and the Western Conference benefited from their efforts for half a century. So what happened to all these brilliant and energetic women ordained in the 19th century? Why didn't we learn about them and study their lectures and sermons in theological school? And why did the number of women ministers drop so sharply during the first 75 years of the 20th century? And why had it been 100 years since the Oak Park Church last had a woman minister? The decline of the Iowa Sisterhood and of the presence of women in the Unitarian ministry generally was the result of many factors. Three stand out in Tucker's account, and they have a chilling familiarity 100 years later. First, in the conflict over theological consensus, the Iowa sisters were clearly in what the East perceived as a radical position. In the East, the group in the center was called the Broad Church Group. And one of the underlying assumptions of that Broad Church Group of the East was that institutionalized religion was a man's world. Grindel Reynolds, American Unitarian Association secretary from 1881 through 1894, simply did not take the work of the women ministers seriously. Mary Safford complained that when she wrote asking him to send tracts, he sent only a handful, even though her congregation was very large. She had to order them through a man in order to get a large quantity. Along with this failure to take the women seriously went a strong resistance to placing women in the pulpits. When Samuel Eliot became AUA secretary, he was, in Cynthia Tucker's words, unaccustomed to treating the opposite sex as colleagues and business associates. He was unable to see any reason for changing the social structures, and he voted against women's suffrage in Massachusetts. He was just as sure that women should not be in the pulpit. Women ministers were simply not recommended to flourishing churches. If they were recommended at all, it was to churches who had already voted to close or were too small to pay enough for the minister to live on. Those women who were already settled stayed on as long as they could, but eventually they took their ministry elsewhere. A second factor in the demise of the Iowa Sisterhood was that the old assumptions about women were strongly reinforced by a perceived lack of masculinity in the ministry and in the culture generally. The ministry, it seemed, was not attracting robust men, and the denominational leaders were encouraging a manlier ministry. Thus, they were very eager to move the women out. A third important factor in the collapse of the sisterhood was disillusionment. The sisters had made their churches welcoming and home-like to meet the needs of the people, but they had also preached a strong gospel of social reform based upon the building of character. As the years wore on, it became increasingly clear that their congregations were not going forth to change the world. This disillusionment was widespread in the society, but it hit the women ministers with particular force. They had devoted their professional lives to the cause of liberal religion, only to see once thriving churches close and the social ills remain. It was a heavy convergence of factors. Looked upon as radicals theologically, unappreciated and discriminated against professionally, and torn by inner disillusionment, many of the sisters turned to social work or teaching or threw their energies into campaigns for suffrage or for peace. As they had tried to make their churches into homes, they took the same kind of ministry into the community, campaigning for cleaner streets, sanitary conditions, and better government. Most of the sisters lived out their later years in poverty. Their writings mostly lost, not only for lack of money to publish them, but because no one thought they were important enough to keep. Reading about these 19th century women, I'm sometimes overcome with a sense of deja vu, of echoes. Here we are, more than 100 years later. I've attended most of the UU women's convocations over the years. And where are our women theologically today? On the growing edge, just as they were 100 years ago. preaching an inclusive, accepting religion of cooperation and partnership, expanding our horizons to include our ancient past, the earth and its creatures, and the wealth of our human diversity, hoping to be catalysts for social change. But what are these rumors or echoes that I hear? The idea that maybe we've gone too far and become too radical by accepting pagans and mystics into our midst. That maybe we're losing our UU identity and need to draw some of the same old lines and boundaries. The fact that my sisters in ministry still earn somewhat less than the men and have a harder time getting good full-time positions. And until very recently, their names were sent mainly to difficult, struggling congregations. But some of the sisters are succeeding, we say. Well, so did Mary Safford 100 years ago. The suggestion that maybe there are too many women in the ministry and a feminized ministry will mean that the profession will lose status and not pay as well. Are we embarking once again on a search for a manlier, more masculine ministry? And the sad message that my sisters are disillusioned, and many do not want a pastorate, but want to minister elsewhere and still be recognized as ministers. Did you know that many of the 19th century women ministers were simply dropped from the register when they no longer served as parish ministers? Disturbing rumors. But let us be hopeful. Reverend James Zepka acknowledged the full range of our diversity at the Service of Living Tradition a few years ago. A few sisters have been called to very large churches, and one of our more recent organizations today is the Society for the Larger Ministry, organized to recognize and support community ministries. It's important that we know and teach our history as women ministers so that we will not be taken in by old sexist attitudes in new disguises, nor stifled by our own disillusionment. Since 1975, there has been a dramatic increase in the number of women UU ministers. By 1986, our numbers had increased from 41 to 183. And by 1990, we had 268 women out of a total of 1,181 UU ministers. And in 1999, we made the front page of the New York Times when women finally made up 50% of our ministers. So let us then be optimistic, like the 19th century women ministers. In 1890, Mary Ashton Rice Livermore said, "Courage then, for the end draws near. A few more years of persistent, faithful work, and the women will be recognized as the legal equals of men." Not quite yet, but keep things stirred up, she said. Don't let the people forget. The time is coming when if we continue this work, victory will come. You and I may not live to see it, but history will tell this story to our children and our children's children, down to the latest generation. No one can yet see the way out, but there is a way out, and we shall yet find it. Nothing that is evil can permanently succeed. Nothing that is right will forever be overcome. And the time is coming in the not far distant future when we shall celebrate.